You're listening to Atlanta Baseball Talk, your weekly podcast for all things Atlanta Braves.
Welcome to show number 300.
Woo!
And the rehearsal we did with that coordinated woo really worked out.
Yes, exactly.
And I totally blew my
Where were you, Curtis?
No. Today
no solo woohoos.
Today is Sunday, May 31st, 2015, and my name is Steve. I am joined by both Hamilton and Curtis. And guys, tonight's show is sponsored by Front Row Seats. If you're looking for Braves tickets or any other types of sporting events or shows, you'll get them at the best price online guaranteed. Use discount code ABT at the Front Row Seats checkout page, and you won't pay any service fees. Visit frontrowseatsllc.com or download the Front Row Seats mobile app. That's frontrowseatsllc.com. All right, guys, in tonight's show, we'll talk about the 3-4 week, the shaky bullpen, as well as the trade with the Dodgers. But first, we are thrilled to be joined by legendary Braves pitching coach Leo Mazzoni. Leo, thanks for helping us celebrate our 300th in style. How are you today?
I'm doing great. It looks like a beautiful day and certainly going to enjoy it.
All right. Well, look, Leo, we got lots to cover in your long career, so let's get to it. I want to start with the early days. Thinking back to your first days with Smoltz, Glavine, and Avery, did you see greatness in all of them immediately?
Well, we certainly saw the potential for greatness, and the only way they could achieve that is to stay healthy. So I saw Tommy at a young age in the instructional league, and I thought for his first year in pro ball that he'd already was very, very much ahead of his time maturity-wise. In other words, Tommy never had that rookie look about him, whatever you call that, but he had a veteran presence. When he signed, he had a veteran presence. With John Smoltz, it was tremendous stuff and great ability. When Bobby Cox made the trade to acquire him for Dor Alexander, and you know, with Maddox, he was already good when he got there. And the mark of a good pitching coach is not to mess up a great pitcher. and we got to see him up close and personal, you know, against us. And then I got to be with him in the All-Star game in '92 before he came over in '93. So. With Maddox, you knew he was, you know, that was something that he was already good when he got there, and he not only was good when he got there, but he may even got a little better when he came. So, being with a better ball club, sure. And playing for Bobby Cox. So, anyway, with Glavine and Smoltz, and Steve Avery was a young kid. Well, we had all these kids in Richmond: the Kent Merkers, the Mike Stantons, the Steve Averys, the John Smoltzes. Glavine in the instructional league, and the list goes on and on. And all of them came through with a lot of help in our run for the great run that we had. So it was a great time developing pitchers. Bobby Cox was the general manager at the time and said that he was going to turn an offensive-oriented organization into a pitching one. Wanted to know who was going to take care of all these pitchers, and he allowed me to do that. And it turned out real well. And then we all got rewarded in June 22nd, 1990. And when Bobby said he named me the pitching coach, and he said, "You got any questions, Leo?" And I said, "Yeah, I got one." He goes, "What's that?" I said, "Who's the manager?" And he says, "Me." So it all started, the building of that great pitching run started in 1986 when Bobby Cox became the general manager.
So sticking with Smoltz, Glavine, and Avery, did you have an idea? Like, if you have to think back now, which one did you think was going to have the most success?
Well, you know, if you looked at just pure stuff, I thought John Smoltz had great stuff. Steve Avery had great stuff. And Tom Glavine had a great mental toughness. Now, if you want to light up stuff-wise, I mean, Smoltz had as good a stuff as anybody that we had in that run. And Steve Avery, for 6 years, was absolutely outstanding. And Glavine was steady as she goes, but all of a sudden Tommy turned his game up a notch in September of 90 when nobody was noticing. I think he won 3 or 4 games in September of 90, and nobody was paying attention to the Braves rotation at that time, but we were building something for the following year, and Glavine and Smoltz and Avery and Pete Smith and Charlie Liebrandt all of a sudden were pitching extremely well in September of 90, but going unnoticed because of the Braves record. And then, of course, in 91, they all take off. But to just look at them and say they all had qualities of greatness, but they're all different. Mostly with the stuff, Avery with the stuff, and Glavine with great mental toughness. But all of them had great mindsets, you know, and it's because the mindset determines how you're going to perform.
Leo, can you point to anything in that September of 90 about Glavin that sort of flipped a switch?
Well, he started to perfect his changeup, and he did that, which made his fastball extremely quick. And then, and so he was pitching extremely well. Now in 91, here's what changed everything. In 91, with Glavin pitching, all of a sudden, John Searles becomes a general manager. We have a new third baseman, new shortstop, new second baseman, new first baseman, new outfield, all with, that played great defense. So when Tommy knew that there was a great defense behind him, he was more aggressive in the strike zone and changing speeds. And that's what happened. I mean, you know, and so the launching pad was dismissed. There's no such thing as the launching pad anymore. Oh, you'll never get pitching in the launching pad. And then we ended up with great defense because they started to fix up the Fulton County Stadium infield to slow it down just a little bit, you know, because it was like lightning quick. And and then gave our defense more range. So therefore, when you look at the entire picture, the defense behind Glavin gave him the confidence to attack the strike zone more.
So, Leo, which season was most satisfying for you, 91, 95, or not even any of those?
They all were. I didn't have one that was any more satisfying than the other. You know why? Because we got to the postseason 14 years in a row, so they were all satisfying. And the pennant races, you enjoyed. I never felt any pressure to maintain a high standard of excellence. What I felt was in April and May trying to get our pitching staff in position to be healthy and make that pennant run and make that chase. And the thing that we were most proud of was the lack of arm injuries over a long period of time that allowed us to get to the postseason 14 straight years in a row. And I enjoyed every single minute of it. And not one year, of course, 91, I mean, my golly, I mean, we turned the city upside down. That was tremendous, but we just kept on going. So every year it was a joy to come to the ballpark. There's no pressure when you're expected to win. It's when you're losing that you feel it, not when you're winning.
Right. So Leo, about the health of the pitchers, I know you've spoken a lot about the love of the radar gun and the love of the 95 and higher. Do you have any theory as to why folks aren't making that connection even in 2015 and not going back to, you know, let's teach guys to pitch as opposed to just throw?
Well, I think the bottom line is what you just mentioned. The term velocity is what's ruining arms, and it starts like we, you know, kids are being told they're not going to make a traveling all-star team if they don't hit a certain number on a radar gun, or they're not going to get a scholarship, or they're not going to sign. So basically, everybody's getting away from throwing more often with less exertion, and what they're doing, they're throwing less, and then when they do, they're airmailing it. And I think that if you need a number on a radar gun or a number of innings on how much you should use a pitcher, innings limits, I think you shouldn't coach. So, you know, it's like, you know, every day I see a pitcher being taken out after six or seven innings, and they only got anywhere from 79 to 90 pitches, and they're out. I mean, and to me, the relievers are the ones that are getting abused, and nobody learns how to pitch. Everybody says, oh, we had a great practice session today, threw 25 pitches flat-footed at 45 feet. Well, would you give me a break? You practice your craft at 60 feet, 6 inches, going downhill to a catcher, and you try to do it as often as you can. And when you say more often with less exertion, basically what you're saying is find out the amount of effort you have to put on a pitch to get the end result that you want. Then when you get to that comfort zone on the effort, then you lower the risk of arm injury. But you can't do that by not going out and working on it on the mound. That doesn't mean you're airmailing it. That means you're trying to acquire touch on the baseball. And that's what we did. You know, I let the pitchers throw as much as they wanted. They encouraged them to throw. But now it's completely the opposite, and clearly it's not working. Guys are getting Tommy Johns now. They don't even accumulate any innings. And it starts, and I think it even starts in the farm system with the mindset. The mindset is, no, you can't do this, you can't do that. Don't let them do this, don't let them do that. And the greatest teacher of pitching is innings pitched. Now they're taking that away from them.
Yeah. All right, so Leo, thinking back on the work you did with all the pitchers in your career, we know about the big names, but which pitcher and his results are you most proud of? Well, you know, folks maybe we aren't thinking of.
Well, I wonder, you know, I think, remember Ori Sosa?
Yeah.
He won 11 or 12 games one year for us, and and came out of nowhere. And his mother gave me a little facsimile of a rocking chair with a bald guy sitting in it and said, thanks for helping out my son. And so you look at those types of things. You look at a couple of kids that had good years. Damian Moss had a good year 1 year. Horacio Ramirez had a good year 1 year. But then you look at the veteran guys, too. I love how we turned the careers around for Jarrett Wright and John Burkett and John Thompson. And I'm sure, you know, I loved working with Kevin Millwood and Denny Nagel and Mike Hampton. And the list goes on and on. The great relievers, Greg McMillan. I look at all the different closers we had. Well, a lot of the times those closers weren't, they weren't throwing rockets. They were just pitching an inning. Greg McMichael closed a lot of games with an 83-mile-an-hour fastball with a great changeup. Mike Remlinger, Rudy, I mean, the list goes on. I'm probably forgetting people that I should mention. But they all had one thing in common. They all loved to throw. They all loved to go about their business. They all understood the idea of fastball command and changing speeds. And they couldn't wait to go down to the bullpen and throw. I had one pitching coach say, well, you know, Mazzoni, as much as you have your pitchers throw, they won't have anything left in August. And I said, well, what do you do when I have them throw that extra day? He said, well, we play flat-footed catch out in the outfield. And I said, well, why don't you explain to me the difference between flat-footed throwing in the outfield and throwing on a mound at 60 feet, 6 inches going downhill to a catcher? And he said, well, they'll have a tendency to throw too hard. I said, well, that's what the hell they pay you for, is to regulate the effort. If you can't do that, you shouldn't coach. And then you had programs for your relievers. Say if a reliever didn't warm up or get in a game for 2 days, I would have a reliever come throw it before the game, just like you would a starter prepare for his next start. And the thing was this. I've had certain people say, well, you can't do that. He might get in tonight. My answer was, that's what we're preparing for, that he gets in tonight. We're working that he'd be effective when he does get in tonight.
Leo, do you think it's just sort of fear of losing one's job in the GM ranks these days, where they don't utilize your methods anymore?
Well, when I met Johnny Sain, who was, I'm not talking about old school here. I don't want to hear this old school stuff. When I met Johnny Sain, you know, he was in the minor leagues, and he had working with the Braves pitchers in the farm system, and he had the greatest record of any pitching coach in the history of the game, and that's why I picked his brain. And knowledge is intimidating, and some people don't want to hear what we did. I mean, I talked to Glavin about it in Cooperstown, and I said, Tommy, what if we told the organizations now what we used to do from the early throwing program all the way through October and never changed it one bit? What do you think they would say? And they'd say, well, they'd probably say you can't do that. And that's the way it is now. I mean, I could go in and explain to somebody how we did it to certain baseball people. Probably a majority of them, they'll say, no, we can't do that. You know, I had a farm director call me years ago and say, Leo, you used to run 80 pitchers through the farm system in spring training. How did you do that? And give me what you did the first week. Well, I got to the third or fourth day, and he told me, he said, well, you can't do that. I said, well, you just called me and asked me. He says, you mean to tell me you allow a pitcher to throw a breaking ball the first week of spring training? I said, are you kidding me? I said, a wise man told me one time that you bring all your pitches along at the same time. And you know, so anyway, he was wasting his phone call. So those are things that I hear. And then when I hear how certain pitchers are described and what they're trying to do. Well, he has an innings limit here, and he has this here, and he has this here. It kind of insults your intelligence, to be honest with you.
All right, Leo, as a fan, as I look back on all the postseasons with the Braves while you were there, the thing that sort of tortures me the most is the Leyritz hit off of Wohlers in 96.
Right.
How much does that stick with you or some of the other postseason, losses?
It doesn't. I'm very proud of being a part of those postseasons. It doesn't bother me a bit. And I was very proud of that. When Wohlers gave up that home run, he came in the dugout and he felt lousy, you know, in the dugout. And I'll show you the genius of Bobby Cox. You know, somebody's hollering in the dugout, how can we throw him a slider? He throw 100 miles an hour. How can we throw him a slider? You know? And so I looked down at Wohlers, and, you know, Wohlers can hear this, you know, and he feels bad already. I told Mark, Mark, don't ever second guess yourself on that pitch. I said, because if that ball was in the dirt, I said, he'd have missed it by 3 feet. I said, so you're not the first one to hang a slider. You won't be the last one. So shake it off. And, Bobby Cox said something interesting to me. He said, you know, isn't it something, Leo? I said, what's that, Bobby? He goes, well, you got a pitcher out there that throws close to 100 miles an hour. He says, and then he gives up a run or gives up a hit on a fastball, and somebody will say, well, you got to mix in another pitch every once in a while. And then they say, well, as soon as you mix in another pitch and it gets hit, then you say, well, how can you do that? You throw 99 miles an hour. So you see what I mean? Everybody has the answer after the fact, but there's very few that have it before the fact. I had very few people, but the greatest teachers I had in the game, like Bobby Cox and Johnny Sain and Jim Beacham, taught me a tremendous amount of ways how to not only handle pitchers, but the mental and physical approach. And then I had a whole bunch of people in my 42 years in the game that taught me how not to do it, and I learned a lot from that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I've certainly been part of countless conversations about how does he not throw a fastball in that situation. But, you know, you're right. Hindsight, of course, is 20/20.
Well, the late, great Eddie Matthews told me one time when I was a young pitching coach in the big leagues, he goes, I'm going to tell you what, Mazzoni. He says, you make sure you tell your pitchers this. I said, what's that, Eddie? He goes, you tell them we can time a jet coming through that strike zone if we see it often enough.
Right.
And I've never forgotten that.
Yeah. All right, Leo, I want to move past your time with the Braves. And when I read articles about that first year that you were in Baltimore, it often reminds me of articles I read about when Larry Bird started to coach, and they talked about his frustration of, you know, thinking about the kind of player he was and looking at the guys around him, and they didn't have that same level of commitment or intensity or what have you. So when you look back on it now, would you have done anything differently that first year in Baltimore?
Well, I think I would have. As I look back on it now, I think I would have been a little more accepting of the ways of Baltimore because I couldn't do that. I couldn't accept the ways because I didn't see the any type of loyalty. I didn't see any type of work ethic, and we were trying to establish that. And it wasn't the players; it was among the coaches. I mean, the coaches didn't want anything to do with me. And then you had the chain of command that was allowed to be broken, where players could go and complain upstairs about stuff, which in Atlanta that never happened. The chain of command was never broken, and so you had a wishy-washy situation. And it was actually the coaches that made me feel more uncomfortable than the players, and I really had no chance. I was up against the wall. And you know what? The interesting thing is too, I got this wonderful contract from Peter Angelos, the owner, and I never sat down and had one conversation with him the entire time I was there, not one time. So he didn't take the time to get to know me. You know, the trainers, they used to do everything they could to keep people off the field, whereas, you know, in Atlanta did everything they could to put the guys on the field. And then nobody would ever take the field on time. Or, you know, I couldn't stand that we had to wait for somebody to come out that was coming on the field late and our pitchers ready to go. So I would voice my opinion on that and voice my opinion on what needed to be done in order to get things squared away. And apparently, you know, they disagreed with me, and I don't understand why, because I was bringing all the things that I'd learned in Atlanta and tried to give them to them, and nobody wanted to listen. So, but we did have some success. We had Eric Bedard had two great years in Baltimore. I mean, before we got there, you never heard of Eric Bedard, and once we left, you never heard of him again either. He had two great years, and he set an Orioles strikeout record one year. Jeremy Guthrie's still pitching now for Kansas City. Had a great developing year when we put him in the starting rotation, and we had and Daniel Cabrera was a 6'10" right-hander. He was 9-10 with 178 strikeouts or so. Everybody thought he should do more, but Daniel was he never played baseball till he was 16 years old, and so therefore he wasn't aware of where his defense was or anything like that. But he still had a pretty good year. But in the meantime, now I don't even think he's pitching anywhere now. I think he's in Taiwan or somewhere. I don't know. But anyway, we did have some good things happen, but we were fighting City Hall, and that's basically what it was. We were fighting the good old boys club, and that good old boys club didn't give Sam Perlazzo much of a chance to get the job done. So that's how it turned out. But we did have to do some good things there.
So, Leo, do you have any theories as to why the Braves organization hasn't invited you back in some capacity over these past years?
No, not really. I mean, I don't think so. I mean, you move on, you know. I mean, it's a different time and a different place, and they have their own system now, and there's nothing wrong with it, and you know, you just move on. I mean, that's, and you know, that's the best way I can explain it. I mean, other than that, I really don't know what else would be a reason for it, to be honest with you. They've always treated me with great respect and great kindness when I go down to check out some ball games, and they invite me in the booth and say hello, and you know, and have, they make me feel real comfortable there. So, I mean, I don't know what the reason would be, or if there is any, except that it's just a different time and a different place.
Sure. All right. Well, Leo, let's finish up with looking at this year's team. So we're recording this Thursday morning after Tehran's start in L.A. this week. Do you think Tehran will find consistency, be that ace he's projected to be?
No, I don't think he's an ace. I think he's a darn good pitcher, but I don't think he's an ace. If I'm looking at aces in the big leagues now, you think Bumgarner's an ace?
Yeah.
Is Kershaw an ace? Okay, Scherzer an ace? I mean, I can name a bunch of aces.
Would you throw now, Miller in there? Shelby
Miller is having a great year. Right now he's the number one on the Braves staff. There's no question about it.
Sure.
But I love the way Alex Wood competes, and then he competes like a son of a gun. But you know, if you're grading staffs, Julio Tehran, guys like Tehran and Alex Wood, Shelby Miller could be a little bit higher than that. If those two guys are, just think about this, if they're back into the rotation guys, that means you've got a great staff that has a chance to win a pennant. If they're your top two rotation guys, then that means you're just so-so. That's not a rap against. I like Tehran. I like Alex Wood. I love Shelby Miller. You know, but what I'm saying is, if the ace is a term that's thrown around very loosely in Major League Baseball, and don't worry about an ace. The Braves starting pitch, and they're running out. Their guys, they're getting more out of what they got than most can. You know. But I think what's happened is injuries have caught up as far as losing your guys that you wanted to keep together for a while, like the Beaches and the Medlins, and then you add the other guys, and or your bullpen now is completely different. But you know, injuries do catch up with you at some point in time when you have depth on the pitching staff. But I mean, the guys are still pitching pretty good overall. That's for sure.
So they're
back into the rotation starters.
Yeah,
which is fine. They're good. They're good big league starters, but not aces.
So you think Tehran's a back end of the rotation starter?
I think he's a number three, number four starter on a pennant-winning staff. You notice how I'm wording this now.
Yeah.
Because I don't want somebody to say, well, Mazzoni said Tehran's not a – he's a solid major league pitcher.
Right.
And he could pitch in any rotation, a rotation where he would be okay, if he's pitching with the Dodgers, where's he pitching? Back into the rotation?
Sure. Sure.
Okay, if he's pitching with San Francisco, where's he pitching? Back in the rotation?
Yep.
If he's pitching with the Washington Nationals, where's he pitching? Back in the rotation? You look at St. Louis Cardinals, back in. I mean, you can go on and make it's the Pittsburgh Pirates. You can go on and say all the great teams that are pitching right now. Well, just ask yourself that question, and there he is. But he's in the rotation. You see what I'm getting at there?
The point
I'm trying to make?
I do.
Okay, there you are.
So let's forget ace. Let's just talk about consistency with Tehran. I mean, his last three of his last six starts, he's given up 10 hits. Is there what do you see out of him? What's different this year? Because he's
facing adversity. Okay, so now he's starting to find out that you're going to have to make some adjustments. It's a constant game of adjustments. But when I look at him as a pitching coach, I think that his angle is flat on his pitches right now, and balls are moving laterally instead of having a better angle. A little bit more north and south, and I think if he goes forward toward home plate, I think that his body goes down a little bit and he's going at a flat plane. So you know, it basically, when I'm looking at it, and I'm sure they're taking care of that anyway. This is just me giving my opinion. This is not telling anybody how to do it. I would have him stand taller and try to change the angle on his pitches, because right now his pitches are hanging around the middle of the plate a little too long, regardless of what pitch it is. Plus, the fact is that I would spend 85% of my practice time working on fastball command down and away, righty to righty. Hmm.
All right, let's finish up with this, Leo. How good do you think Foltynewicz can be?
Oh, I think he has a chance to be very good. In his last start, I thought he had very good command. I like his mound presence. He doesn't look like a rookie to me on the mound. He reminds me, his mound presence reminds me a little bit of Kevin Millwood. Kevin Millwood never had a rookie mound presence when he came up. He had a veteran presence when he got there. Not that he throws like Millwood. Millwood was longer and lankier. But I'm just talking about your facial expression, how you your body language out on the mound, and I love his body language on the mound. Now, that translates into command of pitches, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I love it. Now, you go to Alex Wood, I love his body language on the mound because he shows he's competing like a son of a gun. And the other youngster, to me, he does it in a more of a stoic fashion. You know what I mean? One's more emotional when you look at him, one's more stoic. It's like looking at Avery and looking at Glavin. You know, Avery would be show his emotion. Glavin, you could never know what he was thinking, except he was gonna give it to you anyway. So yeah, I like him. And you know, I like Perez a little bit too. I think he's got a nice action on his fastball, and he's got a good hard sweep on his breaking ball. And I thought he's done real well in his first two starts. So, but here's the key. You know, here's the key to this whole thing. They got to be able to pitch for 2, 3, 4, 5 years in a row to keep a staff together and try to avoid major arm problems. But that's going around all baseball now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's crazy to think about Hanson and JJ and Beachy and Medlin, all these guys we thought would be here for a long time.
And Venters and O'Flaherty.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the bullpen. I mean, but you know, this is what's going on. Bullpens are being changed drastically around Major League Baseball right now because of the use of them. The setup guys are getting abused, as far as I'm concerned. You know, and then they're talking about the length of the game and how long it lasts. Well, there's 10 pitchers used a lot most of the time. You know, or at least 8, 4 on each side, and things like this. So, number one, I think you can change the mindset of a starter and encourage them to go deeper into a game, and they could. You know, and then you wouldn't abuse your bullpen so much, and then you also could if you do that. We always felt that the starting rotation took care of a fatigue in the bullpen or the strength in the bullpen. So emphasis should be put. I mean, I'm talking about Major League Baseball around. Let's encourage these guys to get into the eighth and ninth inning if they're not laboring. I watched 3 games. This was last week. Okay, DeGrom was pitching last week, and he retired like 24 in a row, whatever. They took him out after the 7th or 8th, I can't remember which, and he wasn't tired. And he hadn't even thrown 100 pitches yet, right around there, but he wasn't tired. Kayvon, he had not this last start, but the start before, he's 7 good innings, 7 real good innings. He wasn't tired, you know, but he didn't have 100 pitches. So my thinking is, you know, I would go ahead and encourage them to go back out and let's get into the 8th and 9th, just for the mindset. Now I turn it around and look at Bumgarner and Kershaw. Well, they're both going before the 8th. Well, guess what? Their pitch counts weren't high either, but you got to take them out because they're grinding against each other, knowing that if they give up more than 2 runs, they're going to win the game. So it wasn't the pitch count; it's the effort that you're putting forth, or how you're getting through these innings. You see what I mean? I just gave you 3 different scenarios of 3 where pitch counts are exactly the same, but the 2 of them you take out, and the other ones you encourage to stay in.
Yeah, well, and Leo, I really think it's fear in the GM and front office ranks now about there's this assumption that you don't push a starter past a certain number of pitches or a certain inning, and even if they're not laboring, like you said, if something were to happen in that 8th inning, and instead of putting your reliever in, you left your starter in, and the starter gets hurt, then that GM gets fired. And I think
it ain't the GM; it's down on the field. You know, well, guess what? Let me tell you something. If you're scared of stuff happening, don't get involved in the game in any capacity.
Well, I agree. But I'm saying I think that it starts from the front office about this is how.
Well,
you,
I think
this
it,
is
it
how
all.
You
it,
run.
No, it all starts with the mindset of Major League Baseball now, with all the analysis and everything that's available to them, to try to determine a way to protect the health of pitchers, and it certainly doesn't work. Because some of the equations that you leave out is the amount of effort you put on pitches. Quit talking about velo or velocity, but they're going to. If you watch MLB Network or ESPN, first thing you're going to hear is 100 mile an hour. But then they all blow out.
Yeah. Now you talk to Dr. Andrews, and he refers to it as an epidemic.
Well, here's the thing, too. I'll give you a great example. And this is an example. Jarrett Wright could throw 95 miles an hour, okay?
Yep.
What he learned how to do in order to rejuvenate his career in Atlanta was he learned how to locate 91, 92. See what I mean? So, in other words, he learned, and therefore the ball was still exploding. His mechanics became much smoother, and he made it through the whole year without having a sore arm. So the bottom line is that's just one example of what we did. You know, if somebody says somebody's velocity is down 2 miles an hour, I never mention the word velocity. I don't care if it's down 2 miles an hour. You pitch with the velocity that you have. Now, if you try, what's the first thing a pitcher's going to resort to when he faces adversity for the first time? Okay, maybe Tehran's going through this. I don't know. You're going to resort to superpower and super control. Well, superpower will do two things. You'll start to come out of your glove and already jacked up to unload instead of getting your pitch at the finish, okay? So that rate elevates your pitch in the strike zone. And super control means that you're going to end up being behind in the count because you're trying to paint because you're a little worried that you're not trusting yourself a little bit here, you know?
Sure.
So when you resort to those two things, anytime you resort to superpower or super control, stuff does not happen that is good. Number one, you could hurt yourself. Number two, you're going to elevate your pitch. And number three, you're going to get behind in the count. So anyway, now, how do you acquire learning how to pitch like the examples that I mentioned? You have to go down to the bullpen and practice it on a mound at 60 feet, 6 inches going downhill. Often, more often.
Yeah, no, I know. And it's just not part of the game anymore, right?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
People may debate that, but I go to some games and I don't see much activity in a visitor's bullpen. I don't see any activity. Everybody's playing catch in the outfield, but nobody's down the ball. Every once in a while you'll see a guy get thrown maybe one time. You know, Glavin would throw maybe 5 or 10 minutes the day before he started if he felt like he needed to just get a little more touch on his pitches.
Yeah.
So, and that's and here's what the so-called people say too that don't want to agree with anything that I talked about or Johnny Sain talked about or whatever. You know why they say, well, he could do that with Maddox, Glavin, and Smoltz. That's not correct. You could do that with any pitcher you want. I did it in the minor leagues. The reason I got to the big leagues was Bobby Cox gave me my opportunity because the pitcher stayed healthy in the minor leagues. I mean, if guys were breaking down to minor leagues, I don't think Bobby would have wanted me there to coach then. But, you know, it started in the minors. It stayed that way in the bigs. And to be honest with you, that's the thing I'm most proud of. You can, the pennants, you can't do what we did without guys going to the post. And they used to, you know, the guys used to say, you know, I'm not going to miss my start. I'm not going to be the first one to miss my start. You know, what are you taking me out for? You know, it's a mindset that you create. By no means did we ever abuse anybody. Bobby Cox is in the Hall of Fame because he's the greatest handler of pitchers in the history of baseball. He made pitchers first class citizens, and the pitchers loved it, and they would go through a brick wall for him. It made my job easy.
Well,
the manager.
Leo, I want to thank you so much for your time this morning.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, this is great. I could talk for another hour with you.
Well, we'll do another one.
Okay, that's great, man. I appreciate it. So, hey, Leo, tell folks where they can hear you, where they can find your books, where they can see you around.
Oh, I'm doing my 680 The Fan on The Rude Awakening. I've been with Dickie Broadcasting now for 8 years, and I enjoy it very much. They've been very good to me. So I do it the first game of every Braves series. Like today, they open up the first game against San Francisco. I do that. And I do it with The Rude Awakening. And then on Saturday, I do a segment with Chris Domino and Mark Lemke. And then I'm doing some pitching seminars around the country. I went to Waco, Texas, and spoke to 3,600 coaches for the Texas High School Baseball Association. There was 2,400 in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. July 21st, I'm going to Greensboro, North Carolina, to speak to 800 coaches from the North Carolina High School Baseball Association. And I do work with 6-4-3 double play over there in East Cobb, working with some of the young pitchers there on a periodically. And just, keep busy. Keep busy. Not too busy, though, because my wife and I are on Lake Hartwell now, and we love it very much.
That's great, Leo. Well, great. Again, really a pleasure to talk to you. You take care. Enjoy the rest of the season. Hope we'll talk again soon.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. And hopefully the Braves can hang tight here around 500. And then you never know what happens once you get into the latter part of the season.
That's right. All right, Leo. Thanks again, man. We'll talk to you soon. Okay.
Okay. Thanks.
Bye-bye. All right, guys. Next up, we'll go inside the numbers. But first, a quick word from Front Row Seats. Get the best deals on Braves tickets online. Visit frontrowseatsllc.com and use discount code ABT, and you won't be charged any service fees. Again, that's frontrowseatsllc.com. All right, guys, let's look at some numbers as we review the week that was. So number 3 is the number of wins out of 7 this week. 3 again, the number of shutouts the Braves suffered this week. 16, the number of runs given up by the bullpen this week.
Ugh, that's horrible.
And then the number 1 for the number of impossible and stirring comeback wins that we saw this afternoon in San Francisco. So, Hammy, a lot happened this week. What do you take away from this week?
Well, it was great to end it on a today's note, right?
Jace Peterson. I put up the Jace Peterson poster in my bedroom now.
Okie doke. That's totally cool. So, no, well, it's funny. We've talked about this a lot, what a difference a day can make. You know, when we do this show every Sunday, the Sunday game can be such a swinger. Such a swinger, baby, for the week and the thought of the week. And this week was looking like it was going to be – I mean, after Donnie Veal blew the game again after a horrendous week for the bullpen, I'm like, this is the week. This is a perfect way to end this week, and we're going to, you know, go 1-2, 1-3. But then Jace Peterson came and just completely rewrote that, the story of the week. And I feel like it was not a complete loss this week to split – you know, the Dodgers had the Giants were on the verge of having their best month in the history of their franchise today if they had won it, and to win today was huge for us, and to split the series was huge for us. So, I mean, that's a big takeaway, is today was great. It was really a weak salvager. But the bullpen is horrible. I mean, we knew the offense was going to be spotty. We were going to have stretches of as much as there'd been great signs of a good, you know, good offense and good stretches. You know, we knew coming into the offseason that we had little room for error with this offense. But we need the bullpen to be great. And so when you have a start like Williams Perez's start on Monday night in LA on a Monday night, my personal nemesis game of the season every year, and for him to pitch as well as he did, and to have, you know, Massett and Avilan blow it, and then Miller is brilliant and does everything that he can for a brilliant game, and then Cunniff and Veal blow it. You know, Folty had a bad start, but Johnson guaranteed that we weren't coming back from that game, and almost today. So the bullpen, it cannot be this bad. I mean, we can't afford for it to be this bad. I mean, they blew 3 games for us this week.
I mean, it's depressing and demoralizing as fans, and it's got to be very stressful for the starters, knowing that they don't have a safety net.
And for the offense as well, to some degree, yeah. Knowing that, you know, they've got to score runs, and if it's close going down the stretch, that the pressure is on them even more.
And right? It's insult to injury that you have, you know, Cunniff, who's just been brilliant, really. For him to blow it so egregiously this week, you know, you feel like at least there's a couple guys. Obviously, I'm you know, Grilly and Johnson aside, there's a couple guys before them that you can actually trust. And Cunniff was one of them. And for him to blow it, it really just sort of shakes your whole confidence in the staff down there.
Yeah, especially wrapped up in a week like this one where the bullpen was so bad, right? It shakes it even more. It's like no one is immune to this.
Exactly. Curtis, what did you see this week?
Yeah, a lot of the bad bullpen. I mean, and you bring Massett was the guy they just picked up. You hope they can strike lightning with that guy. He's bad kind of right off the bat. So literally. you're right. I mean, and I was the one that tweeted about the Donnie Veal thing today, but everybody got touched this week. I mean, there was hardly a bullpen pitcher that did not give up runs this week. So who do you go to if you're Freddy Gonzalez? I mean, I know that his management of the bullpen has been long discussed on this show, probably 300 times. But who do you go to, frankly, at this point?
Yeah, and you know, Freddie came out in the postgame comments today and said that Avilan was off, was not available, so he could not go to Avilan there. You know, I don't think we touched on it last week. We may have run out of time. That that Cody Martin was sent down. I don't remember for who, I'll be honest. But Cody Martin was sent down to be stretched out, and you know, to you know, and really the reason is, you know, in his last, I think he had 17 appearances, and in his last seven, he was just pretty dreadful. And like the last three in a row, he'd given up two runs apiece. You know, even the good guys were starting to just get wrung dry. So maybe hopefully they bring Cody Martin back sooner than later just to shore things up a little bit. But it's time to cycle some more guys through because
yeah.
I can't imagine Veal is on the 25-man roster tomorrow in Arizona.
No. Yeah, and one of, and shockingly, one of the few guys, and he only pitched, I think, once, was Cahill, and clearly you have no faith in anything that he can do, even if he managed to get through an inning without giving up a run.
Yeah. And Hammy, as you mentioned it, the offense is spotty, you know. The brilliance of the first month, we sort of continues to be inconsistent now. You've got no production coming from the catcher's spot, as A.J. Pruszynski is actually a worse offensive player in May than Bethancourt is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we miss Kelly Johnson. I think we joked about it when he went down, and it's crazy, but we miss Kelly Johnson. We miss Phil Gosselin. That's how thin the team is offensively. you say you miss Kelly Johnson and Gosselin. Todd Cunningham was, you know, looked great for a while, but now he may not really be the answer. And Freddie had a pretty great 2 days here with his home run yesterday and his home run today. Obviously a big piece of that ninth inning comeback. But Freddie's been pretty awful for the last 10 plus days. You know, without Freddie, the offense has trouble moving. You know, without Freddie or without Markakis, the offense kind of grinds to a halt, and we're seeing that with Freddie sort of being in a, you know, one of the dips in his production.
Yeah, and without Markakis hitting, we talked about this offline. Without Markakis having any power or any threat for power, it just puts more pressure on Freddie, you know. And you start wasting weeks like Simmons' week because you just need more consistency up and down the lineup, which we just don't have.
Yep. Although, you know, on the bright side, Uribe is just a huge upgrade. And we'll get to that trade in a minute. But, I mean, you know, homers in two consecutive days, we're going to get a lot more production, hopefully, it looks like, than we were ever going to get with the Chiaspo-Johnson platoon. I mean, I think we'll see some Johnson at third base. But Uribe seems like, you know, more of a force than Chiaspo was ever going to be this year.
And that's go ahead, Curtis.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, obviously they faced some tough pitching this week. There's no doubt about that. So we can't overlook that. But you did lose your two starts that you got against Brett Anderson and Chris Heston. So, you know, and Tim Hudson was coming off of a terrible start that he had. Kershaw has not been his usual self so far this year, but both of those guys totally shut you down. You know, you're right. It's erratic to say the least. And there's a lot of holes that we're seeing emerge that are pretty predominant right now.
But there's something about this year, you know, not to fall into the narrative that the radio guys love so much and the TV guys, but the holes this year are so much less painful to watch than the holes the last couple of years. Don't you think? I mean, it's just not even.
I think you
meant
not even less expensive.
Well, yeah.
Well, and it's not strikeouts every single time either. So
yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it that makes it less painful. And it's true, Hammy. The less expensive out doesn't feel as bad as the $15 million a year out.
Yeah. And you know, it's tenuous because it's so early, but an infield of Uribe, Simmons, Peterson, and Freeman. I will go to bat with that one. I'm happy with that. I mean, so now we got to get catcher shored up. The offense is still spotty, and maybe if we get Kelly back,
shore up left field a little bit more.
Yeah, sure. I mean, but I mean, you know, this is a rebuilding season. We just have to. I don't care. what you say or what other people say. And, you know, and you want to put good pieces together. And we now have a really good lineup. So let's try to get the other pieces going around it.
Yep.
Well, I think if you look at what the Braves just did over the month of May, I think that that's kind of what the team we're going to be looking at. I mean, so they played the Nats, Rays, Dodgers, and San Francisco. They go 4-8 against them. They played the Reds, Phils, Marlins, and Brewers and go 11-5 against them. End up 15-13. I will take 15-13 weeks or months out of the Braves all season long.
Absolutely.
And you're not going to compete against the best teams. You're not of the caliber. You have some great things that are coming. There's no doubt about that. We've seen some of these young pitchers that are developing, mostly in the starting rotation more so than in the bullpen. But there are promising things. Chase Peterson, you talked about. But we're not at the level where we can go out to LA and go out to San Francisco and have to face this level of pitching and really compete in these games consistently.
We don't have the depth.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, guys, let's move on to Julio's numbers for the week. 8 runs, 10 hits on Tuesday. 3 runs, 4 hits today. Let's throw in 4 walks today as well. Mm. So, you know, it seems sort of silly to ask, are you encouraged by any of this? Because I can tell you I'm not. I mean, Freddie, I don't know if you guys saw Freddie's post-game comments today. He came out and said, I got to be honest, like, this is not the Julio we saw last year, and I was uncomfortable watching him all game. Julio said, it was strange, he said, after the 2 home runs, I'm paraphrasing, I really started to concentrate, and sometimes I save my velocity for the end. Maybe he should pace the velocity sort of throughout. I mean, it's really strange to say, you know, as I was putting together the pitching probables, the pitching matchups for this coming week. Like, I'm happy to see there's just one Tehran start. And frankly, I would rather see any of the 4 other guys out there than Tehran right now.
He's horrible. I mean, Curtis, you go first. But I'll just throw that out there.
He's having a bad year.
Yeah.
Unreliable, I would say. And it's the homers. I mean, he seems like he's giving up tons and tons of... I mean, I looked at some point. I kind of caught the game after it had started, and you would have, oh, he's only given up 2 hits. Well, both of them were homers.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like if he misses, he grooves them.
He really... Yeah, he's catching so much of the plate. So much of the plate. You know, as Leo mentioned in the interview, he just wonders if it's sort of an angle thing. He's sort of flat, you know? And he's... You know, I see that too. Tehran's doing a lot of sort of sweeping across the batters from the, you know, from the right to the left. And he's just catching a lot of the plate, and he needs to. Yeah, I mean, there's an adjustment that needs to be made. I don't know why it's not been made yet.
Well, and his number, I mean, he's just so down from last year. I mean, he's just a completely different pitcher. Last year, he ended up pitching 221 innings, which is great. So, but through 55 innings this year. So he's basically pitched, you know, a quarter of what he pitched last year. And he's given up, last year gave up 22 homers the whole season. Kurt, like you said, he's given up 10 already this year.
12. Count the 2 today.
Oh, that's right. So this is stats not through today. So he's given up 26 base on balls, right, to the 51 that he gave up all last year.
Wow.
So he's like, he's half down. His strikeouts, meanwhile, are way down. So he struck out 186 last year. He's only struck out 49, I guess, with today's 1 strikeout. So he's way down in strikeouts. His earned runs are way up. His runs are way up. Oddly, his hits are not, right? His hits are actually not so as bad at the same pace as everything else is. So he's giving up killer home runs, and he's walking a lot of people.
Right. His slugging percentage against must be so much higher than it has been.
Yeah.
Well, it's his home runs. It's tied for 3rd worst in baseball.
Mm. Well, maybe this week he can turn it around. All right, guys, last set of numbers, 273 as an ERA, 1.089 as WHIP. Those are the career Major League numbers for Chris Withrow, who was the real piece in the Kiaspo-Uribe trade. Hammy, any ideas why the Dodgers made this trade?
To dump Uribe. And then just they just found a buyer and I guess looked at this is, you know, we'll take him. I think that they were sort of backlogged at Uribe. They didn't need him. And they, you know, they have an embarrassment of riches. They're a very good team right now with a huge payroll. So that they said, you know, let's go young with pitching.
Yeah, so, I mean, I get that. But was it just for the PR to not DFA such a popular player? Like, just release him. Just release him and clear the roster spot. I don't know why you go through and why you give up the Withrow, who was a real high draft choice, who had great numbers in 13 and 14. I mean, obviously he's recovering from Tommy John surgery or we wouldn't have traded for him.
Naturally.
But you know, this guy's a power reliever who's going to be a piece of our bullpen next year. I mean, maybe they have so much depth in the farm there in, you know, at that spot too in the farm. But it's just, I just don't get it. And Uribe's been great for us already. My God, the offense he's brought in a week has been amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just strange. And thank you, Dodgers. All right, guys, time for our finding the silver lining, what we can hang our hats on this week. So, Curtis, why don't you go first?
Well, I guess it was last show, two shows ago, I talked about how bad the back end of the rotation had been this year and how it was really hampering us and killing us. Well, not the case anymore, my friends. An amazing week from the back of our rotation between Williams Perez and Folty. Almost 20 innings pitched, only 3 earned run, 18 K. I mean, just amazing stuff from two young pitchers. We hoped that we were going to get something like this out of Fulton Avitz, but I don't know that we ever expected Williams Perez was going to come up and do this. And, of course, the Braves have a history with the Chuck James and Damian Moss and Horacio Ramirez's of the world that we kind of have a guy come up and pitch really great for a year. But let's ride it while it's happening. And, I mean, it's just great that, like you said, that Tehran is the least of the pitchers that you want to see starting right now, and that includes these two guys. So it's nice to have them there and really helping the effort as much as they can.
Yeah, and I'll just add on to the Williams Perez piece. My silver lining is that in his third start, so the Saturday night start, he didn't get rocked in the first inning, which has been the pattern. Like, you can see him getting better, and God, you can see his confidence growing on the mound between his first start and now his third. I mean, it's what a boon it has been to the starting rotation.
All right, more thing. They're sure putting innings in. I mean, they're not going 5 innings anymore. You know, Perez's last start was 7 innings. So
yeah. Hammy, how about yours?
Wasn't he 7 innings both starts this week?
Six was the first one.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Monday was 6.
He had to hurry so that whoever Masick could destroy it for him.
Yeah.
You know, I do want to give a shout out to Angleton and his hit streak that he's had going for a while and just sort of getting on base. I think he's great. You know, I mean, since May 22nd, he's raised his batting average by 20 points, so that's great. But I want to go to Jace Peterson. You know, he didn't have as good of a week as the plate. You know, there was one game where he didn't get a hit, but for every other game, you know, there was one game where he got on base and scored a run. That was a 3-2 win against the Dodgers, but he got hits in every other game. And then we talked about his big, you know, clutch game-winning hit today and he had one last week, right? And so, I mean, he's sort of my big silver lining is it's just exciting to have a young, promising second baseman who can hit for power, who can hit in the clutch, you know, can walk every now and again. I mean, I think it's great. He's my silver lining.
Yeah, I love it. All right, folks, our last word of the night from Front Row Seats. Don't forget to get the best deals on Braves tickets online. Visit frontrowseatsllc.com, use discount code ABT, and you won't be charged any service fees. Again, that's frontrowseatsllc.com. All right, guys, let's move on to Shot in the Dark, our prediction for the coming week. And let's look back on our listener pick last week for Shot in the Dark. It was from Clay Picken on Twitter. He predicted that Freddie and Markakis would have back-to-back homers this week. And I'm sorry, Clay, since Markakis is not actually going to hit any home runs in 2015, that can't have come true. All right, guys, before we get to this week's, let's check in on what we predicted last week. So, Kurt, you predicted that Tehran would go 1-1 and give up 3 earned runs.
Yerch.
Yeah, and now
mine is
talking
much better.
About, like, the first two innings of his first appearance,
off of home runs alone. Yeah,
so he went 0-1, and gave up 11 this week. All right, Ham, you predicted that the Braves would win 1-0 today in the Sunday Bumgarner game. The Braves won 7-5, as we've discussed. And I predicted that we would win two of the three Kershaw-Greinke-Bumgarner games. And we did just that.
Nice.
Yeah, Stevie. Winning the Greinke and Bumgarner games. So, the win goes to me this week. And that's the end of May. Kurt, you won 3-1. Congratulations.
That seems like a push today, though. I mean...
What? Oh my gosh. All right, Curtis, what do you got for this coming week?
I'm going to stick with my theme, the back end of the rotation. We go 2-0 this week with both of their starts combining. They give up one earned run.
All right, so 2-0 for Folti and Perez, one earned run
combined.
All right, Hammy, what do you got?
I'm going to go with Simmons, who I tipped my hat to a little bit earlier. Sorry to have said the phrase, tip my hat. I think that he gets on base in every game this week.
All right. And I'm going to go Freddie breakout. Freddie hits over 350 this week with three home runs. All right, guys, let's look to the week ahead, the matchups that we have this coming week. And let's look at revisit our predictions for last week. So, Ham, you predicted 2-5. No, sir. Kurt, you went 3-4. Congratulations.
Thank you.
On your 3-4 prediction. I was a little high on my games with 4-3. So
Kurt wins again.
All right. So let's talk about the week ahead. So we have 3 in Arizona completing the road trip, and then 3 back home with Pittsburgh. And here are the pitching matchups. So Wood versus Archie Bradley in his 5.28 ERA. Shelby Miller against Josh Colemanter in his 5.05 ERA, and then Folti up against Ruby De La Rosa and his 4.5 ERA.
Ooh, Diamondbacks.
A lot of strong pitching.
How bad are the Diamondbacks?
Goodness. Yikes. Okay. So back home against Pittsburgh, it's Williams Perez against Charlie Morton. Old Braves.
Charlie Morton.
I know. He's still kicking around.
And doing well. His 1.93 ERA.
Wow.
Tehran versus Jeff Locke and his 4.7 ERA. And then Wood against Garrett Cole and his 2.11 ERA. So, guys, when I saw, before we get to our predictions, when I saw Charlie Morton's name, I was like, what was that trade? Because I just couldn't remember. And so we got Nate McClouth in exchange for Charlie Morton, Jeff Locke, who has the start after Morton's, and Gorky's Hernandez. That was a pretty awful trade for us.
Where's Gorky's really, this day?
I didn't look up Gorky's. I just looked up Charlie and Locke.
Who's been very good for them.
Locke's been, I mean, that's two-fifths of their starting rotation. And with a roughly a
2 ERA across the both of them.
And we got the patented good guy comes to Atlanta and falls off a cliff deal with McClouth.
And he was not a good guy.
Yeah.
Well, we
overvalued him.
Well, clearly. All right. So, guys, 6 games this week. Hammy, what do you got?
I think we go 2-1, 2-1, 4-2 overall.
All right. Curtis?
Same.
You know, same for me as well. But that would be a good week. Look, obviously, Arizona's not so good. They're under 500. But Pittsburgh is a good team, and they're a number of games over 500. They obviously have good pitching that we're going to face. It would be a good week to go 4-2. All right, guys, that is the show. So I just want to thank everybody who listens. 300, we're pretty proud of. To get there, and thanks for everyone who's new to us. Thanks for everyone who has been with us since the beginning in 2007. Here's to 300 more.
Yeah.
All right, folks, make sure you have us in your RSS feeds or subscriptions on iTunes or Stitcher so that you don't miss any of our weekly shows. And as always, check us out at AtlantaBaseballTalk.com for past shows, to check out our blogs, and to post in our comment section. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at @ATLBaseballTalk and to like us on Facebook. Thanks again for listening, everyone, and go Braves!
Thanks for listening to Atlanta Baseball Talk, your weekly podcast for all things Atlanta Braves. To find new shows, to post in our forum, or to send a comment, please visit us at AtlantaBaseballTalk.com.